I want to welcome you to It's Rainmaking Time. All of us are concerned about what's happening in the United States of America and the rest of the world, because what we're finding out is that what happens here is affecting people over there. What happens in banks over there is affecting people here. We're one organism, even though we're made up of different people and different cultures and backgrounds and orientations and ideologies from around the world. It is said in some circles that 48 states in the United States are on the verge of bankruptcy, are insolvent, that the FDIC is potentially insolvent and can't produce what it thinks it can. We're looking at the fact that the Federal Reserve is a private agency, and the fact that the Federal Reserve is a private agency has a very unique composite paradigm to it, which means that it can't always operate on behalf of what's good and the common good for people around the United States and the rest of the world. It is true that most of us do not understand central banking. We don't understand puts. We don't understand what it means to bet on financial industries throughout the modern world. When Muhammad Yunus developed the Grameen Bank 25 years ago, people didn't get it, that in order to establish credit, you didn't need collateral. And it's interesting to note that Muhammad Yunus was not a household name until December 2006, he got the Nobel Prize. My guest today is one of the most fascinating, eloquent, well-read, articulate women I have met since Muhammad Yunus, who has a thorough understanding into the financial services throughout the modern world from the ancient times. She not only understands 5,000 years of history and industries and nations and how civilizations transacted business, what is money, how it formed, how the central banking got to be what it is, and what is the Federal Reserve. I'd like you to welcome Ellen Hotchkins Brown, the author of Web of Debt, The Shocking Truth About Our Money System and How We Can Break Free. And what I want to tell you about Ellen is that what's so exciting about her is that she doesn't allow herself to get locked into an ideology. She doesn't allow herself to be politicked or to be involved politically one way or the other. She is for ushering in a solution to establish chartered banks, state chartered banks throughout America. She is a delight, and please welcome Ellen Hotchkins Brown. Welcome to It's Rainmaking Time.
Oh, thanks, Kim. It's great to be talking to you.
I really think that it's critical. You've been on so many different television and radio shows. You've had so many articles written about you. I think it's imperative that the public understand, what do the states have at their disposal right now, states and counties, that you're articulating in your book?
What most people don't know is that all of our money is created by banks when they make loans. And a state is not allowed to create money. That's in the Constitution. But a state is allowed to own a bank in the same way that any private company can own a bank. And so if the state were to take over this power of creating money by forming their own bank, they could do, it could be a win-win situation for both the public and for the state, because they can lower interest rates, they can still make a far better return on their money, because like any bank, they can magnify their deposits into 10 times that sum in loans. That's the way banks work. All banks do this. They all create, they take their deposits and they're allowed to make up to 9 times that sum in loans, and then of course they collect interest on that. So let's say you've got your state revenues, and instead of putting them in these small investments, they're right now they're in very secure investments, but the average return is like 3% on our money, the state's money, and the state has a lot of money. Even though we're supposedly bankrupt, we have a huge asset base. So what, there's one state in the country that does this, and they've done it very quietly for the last 90 years. They own their own bank, and by law, all of the state's revenues go into this one bank, their bank, the Bank of North Dakota. This is a very obscure state. It's one of only two states that actually can meet their budgets. Well, by next year, 48 out of 50 states are not going to be able to meet their budget. North Dakota is one of two that can, and what's up there? There's nothing up there. But what they have is they've had their own bank for 90 years, so they are able to do what any bank does, fan that into many times that sum in loans. So they have one of the best student loan programs in the country. They give very low interest loans to farmers. They can fund their own debt. They are not FDIC insured. The FDIC is now broke, you know. They are they self-insure, and so.
But it's the FDIC anyway is only insured for up to $100,000 anyway per account. So
it's now $250,000, but that's not very much. That's what Miami-Dade County is now talking about forming their own bank for that reason, because they have up to $50 million in one account, and they could get wiped out if the bank goes bankrupt. So if they put them in their own bank, then not only is their money secure. But there's a candidate for governor of Florida, Kavari, who is talking about actually forming a state bank that would not only keep the state's revenue secure, but would actually do what all banks do, which is fractional reserve lending. In other words, turn those revenues into 10 times that sum in loans, and then you could make 2% loans instead of 5% loans to homeowners. You can totally solve all the debt problems of the state. You can make 2% loans to homeowners. So you can take that money and fan it into 9 times that sum in loans. So 2 times 9 is you're still making 18% on your money instead of 3.5%, which is what they would be getting if it's invested in U.S. government bonds or in ordinary, you know, the ordinary investments that they make. So the state has now increased its share by about 5 times, and the homeowner has reduced their mortgage by more than half. So, and what he's proposing is that you can.
What he is, the governor one of the people running for governor,
yeah,
Kavari, Farid Kavari.
Right, he's running for governor of Florida, and he's an economist, and he's picked this whole idea up, and he's given the figures and everything, which I think is just great. I think Miami-Dade should do the same thing. Instead of just forming a depository bank, which is what they're talking about, just to protect the safety of their money, they should actually be using it like any bank does to make many times that sum in loans.
Could you talk about, I think the average person, even the average intelligent, informed person, does not understand central banking or fractional reserve lending. And Steve in the room, is the teleconference bridge, there's a line that's open. I hear somebody breathing, and I don't know if it's muted, but it should be muted till we call them in. I just want to thank you very much. So we're doing this, and you have to make little adjustments so you have a great product. Thank you, Steve. So can you explain fractional reserve lending and how it is? Because I didn't understand this, that you form a liability for every dollar you can take out 9. I hear some banks take out 20 times.
Oh, yeah.
Explain it, because people can't understand it, and a lot of people who hear it don't understand it.
Well, the rule is that the bank is supposed to keep 10% on reserve of – it can make loans, but it's supposed to have 10% of its deposit base on reserves. So people put money in the bank, and what everybody thinks happens is that they put their money in and they get a little return on their savings, and then the bank lends it out at a little more. But that's not what happens. Their money never leaves the bank. That 10% is your deposit base. They wouldn't dare lend out your deposit, because if they lend it out for a 30-year mortgage, what happens when you come for your money? That's your money. So what they are allowed to do is lend out a sum equal to 90% of that.
Oh, my God, 90%.
Of their first deposit. Now, that deposit, almost all their loans are made to their own customers. Let's say you start with $100. The bank is allowed to make a $90 loan, and then that $90 loan becomes a deposit in that bank, because, you know, that's how they do it. They write it into the account of the borrower. That's how they make the loan. So now you've got $190 on deposit. So now you're not allowed to make a loan equal to 90% of that $90. So you can make an $81 loan, and then you can make 90% of that and 90% of that. So it ultimately turns into...
It sounds like a compounding, rolling, snowballing phenomenon.
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I would call it a pyramid scheme, because the problem is they're charging interest on all this money. Banks create all of our money. If we had no banks, we would have no money. The only thing that the government creates are coins. This is 1/10,000th of the money supply. That's like pennies, nickels, dimes, quarters. That's the only thing the U.S. government creates.
Okay, hold right there. Hold right there for the average person who doesn't know what money supply, which is M3, would you explain it, please?
Okay, there's M1 is what people normally think of as money, which is coins, dollar bills, and checkbook money. And then M2 is a broader measure of the money supply that includes more broader things. And M3 is all these remote things that are traded as money. It's very hard to explain, but...
Like instruments? Are derivatives part of M3?
No. In fact, that's a good question, because they quit reporting M3, and that was the reason. Because if you count derivatives, there's something like...
A quadrillion?
A quadrillion, yes, in the money supply, in the global money supply, which is absolutely impossible, because there aren't... The whole gross domestic product of all the countries in the world is 60 trillion. The number of derivatives trades is something like 1.5 quadrillion, which is... A quadrillion is 1,000 trillion.
Number. A quadrillion is 1,000 trillion. So when Bernanke was asked, what happened to the 1.6 trillion? And he said, I don't know. Where did it go? What happened to it? No answer.
Yeah, they're not telling who they made these loans to, and then they're not telling the collateral that they're taking and so forth.
Alan Grayson, is it Grayson, out of Florida, said that, had asked him on the floor.
Yeah.
And I think he said that, they had that right. They were given the right. They had done credit swaps. What is a credit swap? I think we need to know. It's complicated.
I think I need to know, too. But actually, I did read a good defense of Bernanke in that particular case, because what they've done is give the money to another central bank. See, because the dollar has become the reserve currency
of the world,
they need dollars. And so they have a shortage of dollars. And so we have to figure out some way to get them over there without putting ourselves more and more in debt. I mean, that's what's gotten us into trouble globally, is that we've been the reserve currency for half a century, which means we always have to be putting more money out there than we take back, which means, we've been buying stuff like crazy, but basically means we're in debt to the rest of the world. So we've kind of gotten to the end of our rope on that.
Can you answer something that I can't figure out? And I don't want to interrupt you. You were in the middle of finishing something. Go ahead. But then I want to ask you, because it doesn't make sense to me how we can be in debt and actually really, quote, be in debt. I never understood it. How can we be in debt if we can make our own credit? I don't get it.
Oh, that's a more interesting question. Yeah.
Well, thank you. Write that down.
That's a really interesting question. No, I like that question.
Hey, Wendell. Hey, Steve. How you doing?
But apparently, so Ben Bernanke, when he said he didn't know what happened to the money, what he meant was he gave it to these other central banks, and they could lend it to whomever. So that's not really his issue. He knows that they traded it with the other central bank. They don't know what the other central bank did with it. So that was all right, actually. But your question is, how can we be heavily in debt when we have the power to create money?
That's what I don't understand.
Yeah. Well, first of all, the government, technically, the Constitution says Congress shall have the power to coin money, that's controversial, even what that means. But it certainly doesn't give anyone else the power to create money. So if anybody's given the power to create money in the Constitution, it's Congress. But Congress doesn't do it. The only money they create is coins. What happens is the Federal Reserve creates the money, and they are private. They are privately owned by a consortium of banks, and they lend the money to the U.S. government. So the only way the government can get money is either to tax the people or to borrow from a bank, which creates the money as it creates it on its books. Now, why doesn't the government just create the money itself? That's what every government in the world should do. That's what governments have done periodically. And when they do, the international banking cartel comes in and just kills them. I mean, you can name many examples.
Like, give me an example. What do you mean? You mean literally kills them or kills their economy?
Well,
or both?
Kills the economy, yeah. Like Russia, Germany, the Philippines. There's this little island of... There are two little islands off of England that have managed to do this. It's Guernsey and
Guernsey, yeah.
But they're so small. You know, they've done it and gotten away with it because nobody noticed. It's just like North Dakota. Nobody really noticed that they did it. There was a certain amount of ruckus when they first did it. There was a political controversy. But they managed to partner with the other banks in the state. And so nobody really noticed that North Dakota had this totally different system than the rest of the country, and that they had managed to escape this whole Wall Street debacle. And it's actually Wall Street that is the culprit here, and they're the ones that have made out like bandits. I guess you noticed that Wall Street has just paid the biggest bonuses they've ever paid when technically they had the worst year they've ever had. So, and that's because we bailed them out. So, I mean, there's clearly something wrong here. But Wall Street has control of Congress, so what can we do about it? Not much in Congress, but they don't have control of the local government. So that's why I'm saying what we should do is create banks in our local areas. We could have either state banks, or you could have a county bank, like Miami-Dade's talking about it. You could even have a city. You could even have a university could form their own bank. The advantage of having it be publicly owned is all the you don't have to worry about shareholders, and nobody's going to lose their shirt on this. And these are deep pockets. You know, they've got the assets. California has $200 billion worth of real estate, just in real estate. So, I mean, they have a debt of...
You mean real estate as in, like, assets that could function as collateral in order to start a public bank? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, they just have a huge asset base. In order to start a bank, that's a complicated issue, but it used to be that they went according to the reserve requirement, and reserves were deposits. Now the reserve requirement is pretty much obsolete because banks have figured out how to get around it. So then the Bank for International Settlements came in. They're, you know, the foreign head.
It's Switzerland. Yay!
Yeah, of the private central banking system. Yes.
Don't we want to pay them a visit and say hi?
Yeah, my daughter actually lives there, two blocks away from
me. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Did she go give them your book?
She's been in.
Like to settle the matter. We really would. We want to settle the matter with Ellen. By the way, I just want to check in with Dr. Kavari.
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, welcome to It's Rainmaking Time. Welcome to It's Rainmaking Time.
Great to talk to you. I loved your proposal. You set it out so well, and your numbers are great. And it's so wonderful that you're an economist.
Thank you, Ellen. I'm so glad to hear your voice. I'm one of your admirers. I read your book, and that is well-researched and the best book I ever read in my life, I can say about it. I learned a lot from that, and I would recommend everybody to read it who is interested to know about money, how it functions, from where it comes and where it goes, and how we got into this situation as we are today. So I'm very honored to be able to be on the same panel as you are here.
Thank you. I'm very honored to be talking to you. So, So you have set out very well how this would work and how much money it would save the state. Would you mind repeating those figures?
You see, what is happening, people think if they invest in Wall Street somewhere, they will be making money. But the fact is, a lot of people have to lose money in order for a few to make some money. And this is the big problem we are facing. For instance, the State Board of Administration in Florida, they invested in Lehman Brothers over, $110 billion, and they lost some $60 billion of it, and they invested in Cayman Island and so on. Now I have never understood why they would be doing that. When I read your book and then I saw these figures and so on and so forth, I said, you know what? Why the state doesn't create a bank here in Florida, use this money, and, you know, at present time there are like $60 billion. We could multiply that $60 billion by 9 times, you know, that is a fractional reserve banking. We have access to $540 billion to play with. And we can invest in Florida, create jobs, create economic security, provide health care, pay everything what is possible, what is needed. We can do it here. And this is where I get into it, and really I was inspired by reading your book. And of course, as a student, I was always worried about, you know, the powers behind all these things, like Bilderberg Group, Trilateral Commission. I was always studying those kind of things. But really, when I read your book, I understood what's really happening. Now this is the issue. We have to go and create a state bank, provide 2% interest, 15 years mortgage. As a governor, I would be providing 500 solar system every year for next 10, 20 years until we solarize the entire Florida. Now you know how much jobs it creates here, and without ever a penny we put out of our pocket. What really happens, the governor needs to announce that he's going to do this, and every company in the world will try to come and sell solar systems. You ask them to do it in Florida, manufacture it in Florida. So when they manufacture in Florida, we create jobs. And then the installation takes place wherever the houses are. Now it spreads out throughout the state, and we can create everywhere jobs. And from every one job, we create two jobs, and from that three jobs, we create six jobs, and within a year, alone from selling solar system or providing solar system, we will create 1 million jobs.
Dr. Kavari, if I can ask you to just hold 1 second, I want you to hear this as I ask Ellen and you the following question, which really represents the collective ethos of what people don't say when they are thinking about and perceiving a state-run bank. Many people have a disconcerted feeling about governments, whether they're state, local, or federal. In other words, people perceive them as being most of them ineffective, that they don't do good, that there's a lot of waste and corruption. And therefore, on a perception level, a lot of people have an internalized feeling, tone, and image about government. So when you talk about creating a state bank or setting up a state bank, how do you see, and I'm asking Ellen this first, Ellen, how do you see getting over the psychological, emotional hump of people thinking they're just giving more power to the government when a state bank is created?
Well, you wouldn't be giving it to politicians. You're going to have bankers working there. And you can use the Bank of North Dakota as a model. This is a highly successful bank, and it has been very good for North Dakota. They put their revenue, all their income goes back to the state. So they've been a big money generator for the state. And if you want to look abroad, in India, they have state public banks and private banks operating right alongside each other. And the public banks used to be criticized by the private banks because they weren't dealing in derivatives and doing all these, you know, making a lot of profits for their shareholders because they were just worrying about their customers. But then when this credit crunch hit, suddenly everyone is fleeing from the private banks, which are crumbling, into the public banks because they are so much safer and because their number one interest is in serving the customer. They're there as a public service to serve the people. That's what they do.
So how is it that, like, can we move into like a practical application? Let us suppose that today a bank was formed in Florida. Let's just suppose a public bank was set up. How does it monetize itself? Like in a typical private bank, you're going and raising money, right? And putting it into the bank. How does a public bank monetize the capital?
Where does it get the capital to start with?
Yeah.
Normally, you would issue bonds for something to raise money. I mean, if you're private, normally you would be issuing stock to get your money. But the state already has huge amounts of money in various funds, and it's invested in these funds. So let's say you took your rainy day fund. California has a huge rainy day fund.
How much?
I'm not sure.
What do you think?
I don't know. I saw the figures before, but I don't know. I'll give you another. They have $17 billion.
Thank you.
In reserve accounts, you know, in deposit accounts. This is highly liquid money. $1 billion is in regular transaction accounts. $16 billion is in now accounts. These are deposits that you can pull the money out readily, but they're making a little interest, like very little interest. I think it's 1%, but anyway, it's low, whatever it is. So you could take that money and just move it right over. You're not going to lose your money. Here's the thing. You had that money in cash in this.
Who's the you, by the way, just as an example?
Let's say the state.
Okay.
The state could pull its money out of those now accounts, out of all that deposit, of those deposit accounts. They would want to use that for the deposit base, but we're talking about capital. So let's say, but anyway, the now accounts are invested. Anyway, I like the rainy day fund idea, something that's a little more off to the side. If you use it to be the capital base for a bank, you now have a capital asset. You had a capital asset before, you have a capital asset now. It'd be just like if you bought stock in a bank for, you know, $100 million. You took your $100 million, you buy $100 million worth of stock. When you look at your books, you've got the same amount of money. I mean, that's still your money. And as the capital base for the bank, it's not going anywhere. You're not going to lend that money. What you're doing is you're lending money on top of that. That is
right. You're actually, it's not leverage, but it's the fractional reserve for every dollar you can take out. You can create nine.
Yeah. Well, there's two different things here.
Okay.
There's the reserves, which are your actual deposits. Now, you're not going to spend those at all. Those are somebody else's money that they have put into the bank for safekeeping. Or, in this case, we think that a government would put their own revenues in the bank. But the capital base is something else. Now, it depends on the regulator, but
When you say the regulator, what do you mean?
Well, when you go to get your charter for your bank, you've got to persuade the regulator that you've satisfied the different requirements. And I understand that it's sort of an old boys club, you know, and if you know the regulator, and capital is just to show that you've got the money to cover in the event of losses, that you've got a lot of money. So you could go to your regulator and say, come on, Joe, we've got $200 billion worth of real estate in this state. You can just show them that we've got a huge amount of money.
Who does the regulator work for and answer to? Because isn't that...
The state. So that's
okay.
The thing. Yeah, they're your regulator. I mean, if you're getting a state charter, which I assume you are if you're the state. But I should have Mr. Kavari answer that because
Dr.
he's
Kavari,
an econ-
could you answer?
He's an economist.
come back.
You see, there are a lot of money. The state budget in Florida is over $60, $65 billion. And if you take the amount of $60 billion over time they get in fees, in sales taxes, and whatever else, interest and so on and so forth, property taxes and whatever else, it comes to $540 billion that we could play with that.
And just think, times 10. Times
10. Yeah,
or 10. So between 8 and 10, whatever it is. Now, this you could practically, if somebody cared about any state, they could go and build houses with golden bricks. And I don't want to be sound like I'm talking on a political rally and so on, but that is a fact of life. It's the mathematics. Now, to be efficient, I hear a lot of people telling me, oh, you are going to nationalize the bank, you are going to do this, this is socialism, and so on and so forth. In socialism, first of all, nobody owns anything. The state owns. In capitalism, as we have here in the United States, it's elite capitalism. Most of us, we don't own anything. And even if we own it, if we could not keep up with the cost involved, like property taxes, even if you have owned the house and you paid off the house, and if you cannot keep up with the property tax, either you will lose that house or you have to downsize. Now, this is not real capitalism. What we will be creating with this will be general capitalism, that everybody will be well off. Now, it doesn't mean that the rich people have to be taking their money away and be taxed. It's not necessary. For instance, they were telling me, they asked me, oh, the oil company will be against you. Okay, if we put solar system, why the oil companies do not get into manufacturing solar system, and none of the CEOs will live long enough to manufacture enough solar system to cover United States houses. So what's wrong with that? As you can see, what's happening with oil gas stations, they have car washing, they have restaurants, they have stores in their gas station and so on. They are moving in that direction. Why not to move into manufacturing solar system, wind generators, and other alternative energy sources and make money with that? Now, this is one issue. Another issue is I would rather be...
Can you hold 1 second, Doctor?
I'd just like to make one comment on your point about socialism. Socialism does involve taxing, generally what we think of as socialism is heavily taxing the rich to pay for things for the poor. But in this case, we are going to be creating money, and we do not need to be taxing anyone. In fact, we could technically get rid of taxes altogether. I've shown that in my book. I'm going to be difficult to explain
yeah,
right here, but
yeah.
yeah, we could. So what it actually is the original American system that the American colonists had for 100 years before we went to war with the British. And according to Benjamin Franklin, that's what we fought the war for, was to get back the right to issue our own money when King George told us we couldn't do it. So ever since then, won the revolution, but we managed to lose the right to create our own money because of the longer complicated thing. But
the longer complicated thing is discussed in your book, correct? In
yeah.
full detail.
Yeah.
But in the essence, for the listening audience,
we were defrauded, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, the essence was that the British heavily counterfeited the paper money that the colonists used to fund the war. They won this war with paper money. It had never been done before, to win the war with little paper receipts. They had no money, and they won a war against a major power. But by the end of the war, the money was worth virtually nothing because it had been heavily, heavily counterfeited by the British, not by us, by the British. And it had to compete with other currencies, etc. There are different reasons why it was devalued. But it was not because it was a bad idea for the government to issue its own money. It was because of other factors that the founding fathers themselves were not aware of until later. Thomas Jefferson realized later that we had been screwed,
bamboozled.
Yeah, okay. That we've been taken for a ride here. That these pirates pretending to have money had taken over our banking system. So we wound up with a privately owned bank that lent money to the government instead of the government issuing its own money, and then that's what we've had ever since.
So in effect, that by creating state-owned banks, states having their own chartered banks, states can operate in parallel, almost like to the Federal Reserve,
they
but
could
not
do exactly,
you know, exactly
what the Federal Reserve
exactly.
does. The Federal Reserve does what private banks do. It is a private bank.
It's a private
and they
bank.
All create credit on their books.
So it's not so much about, you know, the projection of going socialist. It's states saying, we have the power, we have the legal standing, and that's what I think is so important. By the way, Ellen is an attorney. Say a little bit about that, because what you're describing is an instrument of the law that has legal standing. And that's what's so interesting about this.
Mm-hmm.
This method has legal standing. There's a lot of things people want to do, but you don't have the legal instrument to do it. Tell us why we do.
Ever since we went off the gold standard in 1933, in the 50s, the UCC came in, that's the Uniform Commercial Code, and that is standard law around the world. Basically, all we have in the form of money is legal agreements. All of our money consists of legal agreements. And we are allowed legally banks are allowed to extend credit, but they're doing it in a fraudulent way. In other words, if a grocer extends credit, he's giving you the food and allowing you to pay later. When a banker extends credit, he's pretending to give you his own money, and then you pay him later.
There's actually no
but
transfer.
But he doesn't have
yeah.
the money. But if you are the community, if you are the state, it is your money, because all our money is the full faith and credit of the people, the full faith and credit of the government. And so if you are the government, you are actually, or if you are the people, if you're the community, you're granting the credit of the community. So it's more legal and more proper for a publicly owned bank to be issuing credit on its books, just creating it on its books, than it is for a private bank, which is actually engaging in a form of fraud.
The thing I love about this is that it's a kind of a whole system solution, in that it's practical, it's doable, it's using what's already here, it's using a model, and it's saying, let's go, we don't have to wait on a private banking system anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my question is, most money, as we know, or most currency moves through the cleared through the Federal Reserve as a clearing system. How do you clear the credit of this new chartered bank? What do you clear it through? And will the Federal Reserve, will that bank use the Federal Reserve wire system, right, the clearing system, in order to issue the credit? How will that part, because even though it's a system operating in parallel, if you're doing wires or anything like that,
they probably should become a Federal Reserve bank and, you know, join the system. But North Dakota is not FDIC insured, and today that would be a good idea, because the FDIC is soaking all their, you know, they're doing a special assessment on all the good banks in order to pay for the bad banks, because they are absolutely out of money. They don't have the money anymore. And then they're going to have to go to the government and tap up the government. So if you're a state, you're going to be one of their wealthy wealthy members, so they probably hit you up particularly hard to insure the other banks. So there's a lot to be said for self-insuring if you can do it, and North Dakota has obviously done it very well. And you would think the eighth largest economy in the world, which California is sometimes, could do it as well.
So let's talk about, you said they would, one would join and become a Federal Reserve.
They could or not become a Federal Reserve Bank, yeah. Because join the Federal Reserve system.
In other the Federal Reserve.
And then they
what if the Federal Reserve system wouldn't let them in? How do you clear money?
Well, that's just all up to the regulator. If they satisfy all the requirements, I don't see how they could not be allowed in.
Right, and since we already have one that's working in
North Dakota
mm-hmm. You said there was another state, too.
There are two states that are not bankrupt, but there's only one state that has its own bank. Yeah, I mean, that's a state.
What's the other state that's doing well, Montana?
Montana, but they have oil there, yeah, so that's their excuse.
Dr. Kavari, we want to also open up the line to... Hold on here.
I add something to that about the efficiency of the state bank. I don't know whether Alan agrees with me. There will not be so much of cost involved as it is involved with the private banks because of the CEOs, the high salaries, bonuses, and so on and so forth. Because the state bank executives, they will receive a salary, a good salary, and pretty much that is the end of it. And they will be working. And if they don't want to do it, there are other people, they will be doing it. I do not buy the notion that they say if we don't pay them well, they go away and work for somebody else. Because we are in America, we have a lot of intelligent people and so on. We may not have people that can deceive people like on Wall Street, the crooks and so on and so forth. And I'm sorry for using that word because I see it that way most of the time, because otherwise if somebody is going to be honest, they would not be able to make anything at Wall Street. So here is, we will be having honest people, and then we will be having branches at Walmart, at Publix's, and CVS, and they will be glad to have us there, and anybody could go and get deposit money or withdraw money from those affiliates.
And it will not
cost us any money.
Right, I agree, and we could set it up in a matter of weeks. People say, oh, it would take years to get a bank going, but that's not true. We could do it in a matter of weeks if it was fast-tracked.
So yeah. we would need to talk to Arnold, Governor Schwarzenegger and Bill Locklear, mm-hmm. the treasurer, and I think we're going to do that. I definitely think that we're going to do that. Can we bring in the other person on the bridge, Jim Hoag?
Hi there.
Thank you for being on It's Rainmaking Time.
Hi there. It's been interesting so far.
Hey, Jim.
Thanks for doing this. Hi, Ellen.
Tell us what's on your mind today.
Well, I was asked to be on this for a couple of different reasons. One, a certain level of expertise on complementary currencies, which I don't want to muddy the waters, but I just want to add that you could do everything that you have mentioned so far today and create a structure for a complementary currency as well. And whether that was a time bank, which is one of the simplest forms of a complementary currency, whether it's a barter system, which is another very simple form, or whether you actually issue a form of hard currency, that's not important. It's so simple. It's incredibly simple, and it's legal. And within everything that you have said so far, you could set up a provision for a complementary currency. And, of course, everyone's wondering, well, why would you do that? Well, with the apparent coming collapse of the dollar, be it whether it's being done on purpose by the criminals that have led us so far down the path, or whether it's some form of stupidity or carelessness or whatever, we have to bear in mind that it could happen. And with a complementary currency in place, then local people can continue to do business as they had done business before. So anyway, that's my little introduction about complementary currencies. And
can I just say one thing?
Okay.
Sure.
And I, th- I think complementary currencies are great, but the problem is they're very limited, because if you go to build something, for instance, there's just not enough people in your little complementary currency system that are going to contribute engineering services or, you know, the supplies you need. So it seems to me that a public bank could be set up so that it acts just like a complementary currency. In other words, in a complementary currency system, you basically create the money when you take out credit. Money is extinguished when you pay the credit back. Well, that's exactly what a public bank is. You don't need a pot of gold over here that you're borrowing from, or a pot. You don't have to find somebody who's got the money before you borrow. If you're the public, you can create public credit and issue it to any creditworthy borrowers. So they're basically creating their own money, just like in a community currency system.
Completely with you and Joe Bongiovanni, better spent than lent. And a complementary currency starts running off the ground without needing to borrow anything. And I agree completely that most any complementary currency I have seen is so restricted to massage parlors and dog walkers that it's essentially...
Are dog walkers in the same vein as massagers?
Well, okay, and
aroma, you better correct that quick. For us animal lovers, you better quick it.
Aromatherapist.
There you go. He's now packaging.
I mean, my point is that a time bank is just one of 100 different complementary currencies. Air mileage on airlines, that's a complementary currency. I mean, there are hundreds of them. So let's not.
Yeah. What I was interested in your experiences was how we go about, you've had legislative experiences and you've run for governor and so forth, was how you go about getting legislation like this passed.
I'm sorry,
Vermont.
Vermont. Okay.
Well, I can tell you in Vermont how it's done, and I suppose it can be similar in most states with the exception of the town meeting, which many states do not have. In Vermont, the energy for something that you want the government to do can come from a town meeting. And so let's say there are 50 towns that decide that a state bank is a good idea, then somebody like me would create a network of energy that would put the word out and give a sample warning, it's called, so that every town would look at that, would read that warning, that this was going to be discussed and voted on at town meeting. And if a town has 50 people, it has 50 people. If the town has 18,000 people, then the town meeting is certainly a different structure, but it gets voted on at the town meeting. And that would provide a certain amount of impetus for the legislature to write a bill and get it done that way. Now, another way is for an individual like me. This is how I wrote the bill prohibiting electronic voting in Vermont, which passed. It only takes one person, and hopefully that person has a network of people behind them or with them. And some legislator says, hey, that's a great bill. That's a great idea. I would like to sponsor that. So that's another way to do it. Another way would be if a politician had the brains to come up with a good idea like that on his or her own and then get it into his or her committee. And then it gets kicked around in committee. They all have to get kicked around in committee once they get there. And whether it's a Senate committee or a House, it still has to get debated and kicked around, and witnesses have to come. Many times, as you know, a lobbyist will be the person who initiates a bill. Mm-hmm.
Do you have to actually draft the bill, or do you just...
Well, you would draft it in a preliminary way, and if a legislator liked it, the legislator would turn it over to what is called legislative council, and the legislative council will turn it into the correct form, which some people might call legalese, but I don't. That's a pejorative term that's kind of meaningless. The legislative council turns it into a format that will work, that will mean something, hopefully.
I have a. I wanted to stop for just a moment. I want to check in with Steve in the engineering room to see how much time we have left for this broadcast. Okay, very good. Jim, is there anything else? First of all, thank you so much for your input and for being present. We want to invite you to continue to stay on. We were going to make another call. And, Doctor, are you still on? Dr. Kavari?
I'm there.
Okay, very good. Yeah. We're going to make one more call now to Michael. You want to try that, Steve?
Can I make one quick comment?
Sure.
About one other thing is what is called monetizing the commons. And you mentioned Montana. If you have oil, that you monetize the oil. You turn the oil into money. If you don't have oil, you find something else to monetize. It might be trees. It might be a great supply of water. It might be human resources. But you can monetize anything, including the commons. You can monetize real estate. So if you want to go there...
When you say monetize, I'm sorry, Jim, I just want to make sure for the listeners. When you say you can monetize oil, we understand that on a conceptual basis. But when you say monetize, do you mean using that as a kind of collateral base in which to create money? What do you mean?
That is definitely one way that I mean it. Yes, like gold. If you had a gold mine and the gold was readily available, you put a fence around it and you say this is ours, you monetize that.
So you're talking about that creating credit. Is that what you mean by monetizing in the context we're speaking about? Because I want to zero in on what exactly you mean. And then we have to quickly go to Michael. Go ahead.
I actually mean a little more than that, but yes, I do mean that. I also mean you can just say, we have this, it's worth something, we're going to spend money into the system because behind that money is our gold mine.
Yeah, so it's functioning as a collateral base, so to speak, or it's functioning as money. Oil as money and land as money and whatever as money. Correct?
Yes.
Okay, very good.
How are we? And as long as money comes into existence along with goods and services, it's not inflationary. So you can create money as a state or as a country or whatever, and as long as you can call it monetizing, or as long as there are goods and services to balance it. Like right now, we actually have a shortage of money in the real economy. Although the Federal Reserve is madly printing money, they're giving it to the banks, and the banks are not lending it out to the people. So in Main Street, we have actually a severe shortage of money because there's a lot more things that we could monetize, as you say, than we've got the money for. So there's real estate that's not getting sold or, you know, that's going into foreclosure. I'm just reading about students are lining up. They can't get into classes anymore to finish their degrees because they're cutting back on classes so much that they can't fill their requirements. I mean, we've got the students and we've got the teachers. So can just monetize that whole situation where you've got services and you've got people who want the services. So you've got the thing which you can spend the money for. And so that's called monetizing.
So I want to touch one thing before we call Michael. And Steve in engineering, okay, so now I want to ask all of you who are here the following, but I want to start with Ellen, which is, I'm a lover of gold and silver, and I know it's like a parallel system almost, if you will, but there are so many people that are afraid in the context in which our reserve currency, the way it's being treated and the way money is being just printed at the printing press, so many people are scared and very frightened right now and are running to gold and to silver to own it. They're also going to James Turk organization, Gold Money. And I know that what you're proposing through Web of Debt by establishing a state chartered bank and all over the country is a parallel opportunity. But could you speak to the people that are very attracted to metals, that are in it, that are scared to death of the currency devaluation and debauching? Could you speak to whatever it is you are moved to say about that? So at least we can address the people that are in that realm.
I think gold and silver are a wonderful investment, of course, and obviously because it's going up right now. And if you really did have a collapse of the currency, like happened in Argentina, where the national currency was worth nothing, people developed community currencies. That was one thing they did, just little paper receipts, and they traded things. And if they had some gold or silver coins around, I think actually silver is more practical than gold because it's small. You know, if you went to the grocer, let's say every other form of currency had been wiped out, and you went to the grocer with your gold coin, and you'd say, no, really, this is worth $1,000. And the grocer wouldn't know what to do with it, and he wouldn't necessarily believe you. But if you took a silver coin, you know, that had a reasonable value, like one of those old coins you can get a big bucket of them, I mean, that's a more fungible, practical thing.
And describe what fungibility is to the public, please.
Well, I mean, you wouldn't have to make so much change for it, in other words.
Okay.
It could be a modest sum, $100 or something. I'm not sure what those old coins are worth now. But I don't think a gold and silver as a currency would work. In other words, for many reasons, I've
as a currency a form of money.
Well, you can use it to trade, just as a form of barter. But you don't need to stamp it with you know, and call it the national currency, because there's not enough of it. Even in the 19th century, when we were on the gold standard, it was heavily supplemented, first with banknotes. In other words, there were 10 times as many banknotes issued as there was gold in the bank's vaults. That was the fractional reserve system, and that developed from the 17th century when the goldsmiths figured out that they could lend 10 times as many of these paper receipts as they had gold, because people didn't want the gold. I mean, they didn't want to carry the gold around. They wanted to carry these little paper receipts around, so they wouldn't come for their gold. But as soon as they figured out that there wasn't enough gold to cover all the receipts, there would be a run on the bank. And they had runs on the banks in the 19th century like every 10 or 20 years. I mean, they had like serious depressions and serious, you know, farmers would lose their homes. And
runs on the bank are when everybody runs to their bank to get their money and there's nothing there.
Right. Most people don't get it because the gold's not there. Yeah, exactly. So there was that, the paper money that supplemented the gold. And there was something called the real bills doctrine, which is I don't know how to pronounce it either, but it's F-E-K-E-T-E.
Right.
But anyway,
he's brilliant. Now, he talks about the real bills. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, we're getting remote here, but that's basically, in the 19th century, goods would be delivered on a ship. So let's say they were 3 months out. You know how you take...
like a bill of lading?
Exactly. Your bill of lading is like 90 days net. And that means that you're not going to get it for 90 days. So those actual paper receipts would trade just as if they were money, but they would be discounted. So if it was 90 days away, it wouldn't be worth as much as if it was 30 days away. And if it was, and then of course on the day when it was delivered, then you'd get the full value for it. So those bills would trade without any national currency coming into play. You know, no banknotes, no gold. Those things were trading as money. And now we have many things that are trading as money, and one of them is government bonds. And that's why I think we could pay off the federal debt without creating inflation, because what you would do is you would pay the bond and rip it up. So you would get rid of the bond, which is just as good as money, and you would have real dollars in its place. In other words, you would change an interest-bearing thing, a thing that we, the people, are continually paying interest on, and it's still out there circulating.
Who are we paying interest to? I hear when it's said, and I understand it conceptually, but who are we paying interest to when we have the conversation? Who's the who? Who do we pay?
Well, many people, that's the thing.
Who?
It's mostly foreign central banks.
Okay.
You know, they have most of our debt. The Chinese have $2 trillion right now. Yeah.
Okay.
But there are also pension funds and all kinds of funds own government bonds. Banks are buying government bonds. I
mean, so you're saying we should buy, who's the we that we should buy?
Oh, but when a bond issue comes due, they always pay it off, but then they roll it over. So they refinance it. They issue some more bonds in order to get the money to pay off the old bond. Well, I think when the bond comes due, you print the money or, you know, put it into an account and you say, okay, you've been paid, but we're not selling any more bonds. We're going to sell our bonds now to our own Federal Reserve, which is what they should have done all along with selling. Like you said, why don't we print the money ourselves or have our own central bank print it? If we own the central bank, well, even when we don't own the central bank, the Federal Reserve funds government debt interest-free, almost. I mean, they take out their costs, but they rebate the interest to the government. They've done that ever since the 60s.
Listen to the amount of research and detail that Ellen Brown has, who's the author of Web of Debt. We're here at It's Rainmaking Time. Didn't mean to cut you off. Please go ahead.
Right.
And do we have Michael waiting on premiere? Is Michael on premiere?
Michael's on.
Hi, Michael. Stand by. Just one moment here. I want to let Ellen finish what she said, and we're delighted that you're on. Hold on one moment. Please finish what you were saying.
I forgot what you were saying.
See, I cut her off. That's what happens when you're over 20.
You were talking about Federal Reserve and zero interest.
Federal Reserve and zero interest?
Right.
So
you could pay off the bonds as they come due. In other words, you just write that money into the account. You tell the Chinese when their bond comes due, you say, okay, your 30-year bond just came due and we've just paid you off, but we're not selling any more bonds. We're going to fund our own bonds through our own Federal Reserve. And then our own Federal Reserve is going to rebate the interest. And they never, ever really pay off the federal debt, because the federal debt is our money supply. We have a $12 trillion federal debt, and that's about the money supply. So that money is just out there acting as the dollars in the system. Well, if it's a debt to our own central bank, which we pay no interest on, and we never have to pay it off, we just keep rolling it over. It's the same.
So it's not really a debt, is it?
It's the same.
That's what I said about an hour ago. It's not really a debt.
No, it's just an accounting feature. You know, you just figure out how much money you've spent, and you write that up into the account, and you put the money out there into the economy. And as long as you have goods and services to balance that money, you're not going to have inflation. So the government could, right now, fund all these infrastructure projects that we desperately need. There's so many things we need. We need roads and bridges. They're all falling apart. And look at the teachers and, you know, healthcare. There are all these things that we could fund without creating inflation. We could fund it because we're adding to the goods and services of the economy as we're adding the money. So
awesome.
When supply and demand go up together, you do not create inflation. You just create abundance.
Even get to where they believe in Santa Claus. They simply cannot conceive of this happening without debt. And it's hard to get them off of that.
This is Michael. Michael, introduce yourself.
No, I think that was it.
Was that Jim?
Oh, that was Jim.
Jim, thank you about the Santa Claus thing. But
okay.
You go ahead and finish that. Finish your sentence, and then we want to
have
Michael.
Go ahead, Michael.
Well, actually, I'm kind of jumping in here, having not been listening to the program. I apologize, and so I'm...
Well, I can tell you what I'd like you to speak to. You were talking about I've forgotten where it was. Was it Virginia? That had a bank already going that is a non-profit bank, but it's funded by the government. So explain how that works and why you think that's a good idea.
And just give us a minute, if you can, like a minute and a half intro about who you are and just what your passion is and why you've come here today.
Okay. Well, first of all, in terms of background about myself, that I've been an entrepreneur mostly in the San Francisco area for over 30 years. I started more than half a dozen small companies and pretty much considered a specialist in how do you start up new ventures, and that as part of a new program that we were trying to put together, that we determined we needed a credit component of it, that got me off into investigating the whole banking world and alternative currencies, etc., and found my good friend Ellen and was most impressed with the stuff that she put out. I thought that was the best of the best that I was seeing out there. I completely agreed with the idea she was putting out there about the government at the federal or state level getting involved in banking like the Bank of North Dakota, had my own thoughts about what would work best if we started applying that same concept down to the local community level, that I thought that it would be more difficult for local governments to get involved in the banking. And the alternative there, still maintaining the public ownership concept, we concluded that it might be best done with nonprofit corporations instead of the government doing it. And you still have thus the total dedication to the public benefit. In fact, we call those both the government-owned banks and our nonprofit-owned banks, we're referring to them as public benefit banks. And they convey the idea of that these things exist exclusively for the benefit of and the economy and not for individual owners. So in the process of trying to do our due diligence and research and building the rationale for our whole program, we've reached out there to try and find other examples of these public benefit banks and have now learned of two nonprofits that own banks, one in California that's in Oakland called One California Bank, was the first one we learned of, and that one was actually funded by a husband and wife, very wealthy hedge fund progressive guy, where they put nearly $50 million into the local community bank that they're dedicating to exclusively serving the needs of the low and moderate income individuals within the community there. And then we found out about this other one that Ellen is just referring to, that was formed by the Virginia Community Capital Organization, which was originally formed as a nonprofit, and they call them a Community Development Financial Institution, or CDFI, that VCC, Virginia Community Capital, was formed in 1995, originally as a micro-lending organization working in three counties, and also doing things dealing with low-income housing and things like that. And a decade later, the state partnered with them and actually then provided them with a $15 million grant to form a wholly owned for-profit bank under VCC, which they've now done, and it's called the Community Capital Bank of Virginia. And the whole nature of their program was expanded to go statewide. So what you have here now really is a public nonprofit partnership sort of concept working out, But since it's a nonprofit, they also are open to being able to bring in funds from foundations and socially responsible investors and others that have augmented and added to the $15 million that the state originally gave. And given all of what Ellen so adequately teaches about the idea of the fractional reserve lending concept and how you can take every dollar and multiply it many times over, that's precisely what they're doing to serve the needs of the communities all throughout the Commonwealth of Virginia. And one final point, I just today talked with their chief credit officer there to get a better understanding of how they do what they do, and especially their relationship with the other community banks, which, through Ellen, we've all learned that North Dakota serves kind of as the central bank to the state there and the community banks there. So they really don't have a competitive relationship. They have a cooperative one. Well, in a similar fashion, the folks under VCC and the Community Capital Bank of Virginia have structured their program to be cooperative with the other community banks, and they actually wind up bringing them net additional business to what they currently do now, principally because they know how to handle certain key complex, especially economic development projects, which those local community banks typically don't know how to handle. So all the way around, it's turned out to be a win-win by everybody, and that is certainly a model that we think is one that needs to be added to the equation to the approach that Ellen's been advocating.
Well, thank you. Can you hold right there? Dr. Kavari, are you there? Can we open up the bridge for Dr. Kavari?
Yes.
I wanted to ask you if you have any input at this time. We've had you in the quietude mode for a while, and I wanted to know if you have any input at this time before we go on with the show. We have only 30 minutes left.
No, pretty much everybody said what it should be said, so that's fine.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being here. We're going to continue with Web of Debt, and also, Jim, thank you for being here. You're welcome to stay on the bridge as we continue the show. I think that there's some aspects of the book that we should start to get into even deeper, unless there's some things that you want to address now. I'd like to know, why did you write this book? Or what moved you to write the book? Why did you do this? This is
actually my 11th book. And I was a lawyer before. I was a writer. I always wanted to be a writer. I just couldn't support myself as writing, so I went to law school. And did commercial law, so I actually know about the UCC and, that sort of thing.
Talk about the UCC real quickly, what it is. It's the Uniform Commercial Code,
and so it's basically contracts. But my argument would be that all money today is legal agreements, and that's why you should have a public agency overseeing it in the same way that you have a public court system. You would not want a private court system. If you're going to go have somebody overseeing the deal and making sure that all the parties play fair and stuff, which is what you need this middleman for, you want it to be a public entity that's accountable to the public and not gouging you and taking, all the profits they can manage to get out of the deal out of it and not reporting what's going on, which is what we have going on now. So anyway, I worked for 10 years as a lawyer. My ex-husband burned out on Beverly Hills Law and decided he wanted to go in the Foreign Service. So we were abroad for 11 years. He worked for USAID, and that gave me a chance to write. So I wrote 10 books on health, and I got into...
Name some of your books.
We had one bestseller. I had a co-author on this one, and Lynn Walker, and she's a pharmacist and has many other titles. And it sold 285,000 copies, and it was called Nature's Pharmacy. So what we did was we went through 160 diseases, and we said what the disease was, what the conventional remedy, what's really going on with this disease, not just the name of it, but what's really happening in your body, what the conventional remedy is, basically, in most cases, why you don't want to take this conventional remedy, why it's actually bad for you. It's a drug, and it's toxic normally, and it's blocking. Most drugs act to suppress symptoms. Well, the symptom is your body's attempt to work out the problem, like diarrhea, sneezing, coughing, all that stuff is your body trying to cleanse. So if you suppress those symptoms, you have suppressed the healing mechanism of your body. So our whole contention would be that only the body can heal. And if you're going to get in the way of what the body's doing, you're actually doing more harm than good. So what you want to find out is what remedies help the body to do what it does. So we largely wrote about things like homeopathy, which stimulates the, you know, the body to do what it's trying to do, and just basic natural herbal type things.
But what got you to this book?
Okay, so then when we were in the Foreign Service, I wound up representing, I represented several alternative healers, but the big one was Jimmy Keller, who was a cancer therapist in Tijuana, and he was like one of the most popular people down there, and he was kidnapped by the FBI, taken to Brownsville, Texas, and tried for fraud, the alleged fraud of representing that he had a cancer cure, which I thought he did, because I had talked to all his patients, and I worked on the suit, and I also did a lot of interviewing, and it went on for years. He actually wound up spending a total of 3.5 years in jail for, well, he'd spent 2 years in jail, and then when he got out, he was on probation in Louisiana, and all his old patients came to him and said they were going to die if he didn't treat them, et cetera. And so he did, of course, in violation of his probation, and so he got busted again and spent another year and a half in jail. So through all that, he was actually a very, well, he knew a lot, and so I learned a lot from him about the whole, how things work, you know, how things really work. And one of his supporters was Ed Griffin, who had a movie called World Without Cancer, which linked the drug industry to the bank, you know, the drug people, the banking people, and the oil people are all the same people. So after I read that, I realized that if you really wanted to solve the problem, you have to solve the banking problem, that's where the control comes from.
That's where the action is.
Yeah. So I just, it was so mind-blowing to discover that there is no money in our system. There's only debt in our system, and that it's all created by private banks through a basically fraudulent mechanism. And then I discovered that The Wizard of Oz was written about that. So, I mean, at first I thought, well, that's real interesting, but what can I say about it that hasn't already been said? But then I discovered this whole allegory that, of course, I'm a writer first, and I'm really just a writer in search of a good subject. So when
you're a little more than a writer in search of a good subject. Yeah, let's just create a parallel system with our own state centralized banks and issue our own money, and it's all good. I'm just a writer. Go ahead. You're a very good writer, by the way. This was the most thorough book. I mean, I've read so many books. I've read Muhammad Yunus's book. I've read James Turk's book. I've read so many books in finance and money, and this was so complete.
Oh, thanks. Well, the thing is, most people who write books on economics are economists, and so they're not real interesting, generally speaking. You know, they just, because they're not trained in how to write. But I've spent my whole life figuring out how to say things in a way that would be engaging, you know, and put a little poetry in it, a little sort of spiritual meaning, and, you know, the meaning of life sort of thing. So basically, the philosophy of this whole book is the philosophy of The Wizard of Oz. We've got it all. We can have it all. And abundance is on our feet in the form of the silver slippers, which were changed to ruby slippers in the movie, but they were silver in the book, meaning the silver standard, which meant the money of the people. In other words, we can create our own money. We've been hoodwinked into believing in scarcity when actually we've got it here. The only thing we're lacking is the medium of exchange, and that is merely a series of legal agreements. We can put that all in place.
Stop right there. That's great. So the medium of exchange is the legal agreement.
Mm-hmm.
That's the instrument that is the legal, that's the exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And everything else are what? Mechanisms in which to express that. Is that correct?
Right. Well, it's real obvious when you're talking about a barter system. Like, there are a lot of barter systems that don't involve money at all, or they're just all on the computer. But when you're talking about credit, that's a different thing. You know, when you're paying over time, that's where you need your legal agreement, because you're saying, trust me to pay you out over 5 years. I don't have the money now. Trust me to pay you. I'll pay you a little extra. And so that's where the banker came in, because they really didn't trust each other. They didn't know each other. But they knew this bank, this third party called a bank that had been in town for a long time. So the bank said, basically, okay, we'll pretend to have the money. We'll lend you the money. You know, we'll write it up into your account as if you have it. And we'll charge you double over the course of your 30-year loan for taking the risk that maybe you won't pay us back, and for, you know, because we're in the business to make money and that's what we do. So the problem was because it's an inherently fraudulent system. In other words, they're pretending to have money they don't have. Not only is it bad for us because we can be exploited, which we have been, but it's bad for them, the bankers, because you see what state they're in now. They really don't have the money. So these capital requirements and so forth, they're having trouble meeting because they're scrambling around trying to pretend they have capital that they don't have, or concealing the fact that their books are messed up. And the reason they got into that whole derivative thing was because what they have created is a Ponzi scheme that requires more and more debtors to be sucked in at the bottom. And now after 300 years, we've run out of debtors. So they came back and turned on us, you know, and we became the big debtors. And now there's nobody. So they're scrambling around trying to basically in debt each other until, I mean, the parasite eventually, what's happened is the parasite has run out of its food source.
So what do you see happening as the G20 met and is announcing the request of the IMF to become the new international central bank? And what do you think about the call for using a super currency from other leaders of other nations to replace the reserve currency? And thirdly, and really complicate this good, if the reserve currency of the U.S. Federal Reserve note is changed, will it still be possible to still form a state bank?
That's a good question. I mean, you can certainly envision that there is an element around the world that's aiming for this whole 1984 scenario where we'll be trapped totally, and then we won't be able to
do
anything.
It's looking like that right now.
That's why we have to scramble to set. I mean, that's why I think this whole G20 and they've set up this financial stability board, which is going to regulate financial things around the world, and we've agreed to it. And it wasn't us, the people. I mean, it wasn't voted on as if it was a treaty. Congress, I don't think, knows what the president just did. The president did it unilaterally, just over when he was over there in London. You know, they all shook hands and agreed that they were going to be part of this financial stability board, which would then be able to impose regulations on anything financial. And it's a very broad spectrum of things that they're going to be covering. So that means, here's what I envision. This is what I think they're up to, that eventually they're going to say, they'll come around and check to make sure everybody's playing by the rules, and they'll look and they'll say, oh, well, you're issuing your own money. We think that that's not a sound business practice. And so you have to borrow from the banks. You know, it's only sound to borrow from the private bankers. So they will get rid of any country that is attempting to issue its own money or that is borrowing from its own central bank. And there's precedent for this. The first central bank ever created was in Sweden, and it was a publicly owned central bank, and it was created before the Bank of England in the 17th century. And Sweden did very well issuing their own money through their own they borrowed money from their own central bank, but because they owned the central bank, it was basically interest-free, and so basically they were creating their own money, even though on the books, it might show as a debt. And then when they joined the EU told them they could no longer borrow from their own central bank. The same thing happened in Canada. They used to borrow from their own central bank, and they flourished. Things worked really well right up till the 70s, when we had this, what was called stagflation, and everybody freaked out about inflation, and they blamed the bank for creating money that would fund the things that Canada needed, when that wasn't really what the fault was, but that was where the blame lay. And so, again, they said, even though you own your central bank, you can't borrow from it. You've got to borrow. They started borrowing from the private international bankers. Bank of England, the same way. They own their central bank, and they borrow from the private bankers. Why? If you own your central bank, borrow from your own central bank. Interest free, you know, they let them rebate the interest. So
it's,
I think, what
possible that a legislative act like the Lisbon Treaty is very close to being totally ratified, which
is dangerous.
Briefly, do you know how to explain what the Lisbon Treaty is?
Well,
briefly, and we have 3 minutes and 43 seconds. Can we do the Lisbon Treaty in 30 seconds?
Well, basically, it will solidify the EU.
Okay.
But it's not a good model because the small countries there are being taken advantage of. I mean, assume that you had a global central bank. I think that's what they're aiming for, a private global central bank that would issue the global currency. Well, who gets this money? We will have to borrow, like everybody else, from this central bank, which will put us in debt. If we have trouble paying, will be in the same situation as third world countries. They'll cut back on, they'll impose all these conditionalities where we have to, you know, cut back on services and sell or privatize all our industry. And they, the bankers who have the money, have the gold, will come in and buy all that up.
Hold that right there. This is Kim Greenhouse with It's Rainmaking Time. We want to invite you back with Ellen Brown. And for those of you that are still on the conference bridge, stay on. We have another 2 minutes. We want to thank Dr. Kavari, who's running for governor of Florida. We want to thank Michael, who was on, and Jim, who's
Jim's
in Vermont.
And Michael.
And we would like to come back and do this in a television studio and bring some governors and some of the other leaders of other states in the United States of America. And I really thank you for coming today. Is there anything else in closing? We have 2 minutes that you would like to say and let the public know.
I do think it's very important to become aware of what's going on. Our salvation will be the internet, I think. And understanding, the first thing we have to do is understand the issues, and the second thing we have to do is get together. We have to mobilize. And I've been in many different groups, and we all kind of fight among ourselves, and it's very difficult to form a grassroots movement. You know, it's one thing to have a leader at the top who tells you what to do, and then everybody falls into lockstep. But if you're sort of moving organically from the bottom, that's one big hurdle. So I think we have to work out ways to come together, figure out what our plan is, and, you know, and get out there and do it quickly before their plan.
Before the window closes.
Yeah, exactly.
So thank you so much for being here. I look forward to doing another show with you, taking it right from here. We're going to release this to the public online and then invite many, many more people. Thank you all. Thank you, Steve, in the engineering room. Thank you, Studio City Sound, Wendell Hubbard, and thank you, Ellen Hodgkin. Is it
Hodgson.
All right, let's try it again. And a 1, 2, 3. Thank you, Ellen Hodgkin.
You're going to say Ellen
Brown. No, you do it.
Ellen Brown's good.
Ellen Brown, we thank you very, very much. It's Rainmaking Time, everybody. Feel free to call 626-398-8652. We separate the wheat from the chaff. We have amazing broadcasting for discerning audiences. God bless you.